Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, my name is Megan Zimmerman, and I'd like to welcome you to Women on Wednesday. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones or pagers and stay in your seats quietly until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. An announcement we do have in commemoration with the National Stocking Awareness Month, Vicki and Eric Swenson tonight in the Ritchie Auditorium in Stewart Hall at 7 p.m. And if you have any more questions, let us know after the presentation. Our session today is titled Addressing the Problem of Stocking. The crime of stocking has become an issue of interest locally as well as nationally in the last several years. Women across the nation are working in their communities to halt this form of intimate gender violence by establishing coordinated community responses to enhance a victim-centered approach as well as to improve the legal system's response to victims. Learn about early strategies that initiated local awareness and change, coupled with statewide initiatives devoted to developing protocols to addressing the needs of victims and enhance safety. We have two presenters today. Our first, Deirdre Keyes. She has 15 years' experience working directly with victims of domestic violence and stalking. She has developed the State of Minnesota Stalking Response Protocol in 2007 through her work with the Cornerstone. Keyes recently joined the Batters Women League Legal Advocacy Project to expand the protocol and provide training statewide. She will be serving as an expert witness in criminal court proceedings and as a faculty member with the Stalking Resource Center at two national trainings this year. Our second speaker, Lee Ledoux, is the Assistant Director and Coordinator of the Gender Violence Prevention Program at the SESU Women's Center with over 20 years of experience in the field of violence prevention. She is a licensed social worker and holds a master's degree in human relations. Ledoux currently serves on the State Victim Assistance Academy Planning Board and has been a member of the Stearns Community Family Violence Sexual Assault Council for over 10 years. We are very grateful to have them both with us here today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Keyes and Ledoux.
Hi, everyone. Wow. Response, that's awesome. I'm used to wandering a little bit, so can I take this off of here? Okay. Does it just... There we go. All right. My name is Deirdre Keyes, and I have been working as an advocate for 15 years. I started as a criminal justice intervention coordinator with Cornerstone Legal Advocacy Services in Bloomington, Minnesota. And a criminal justice intervention advocate will follow a case from arraignment through trial where there has been a police report and police involvement and possibly an arrest with the victim. And as we were going through our caseload in my staff meetings, we came to realize that we were able to identify a stalked victim, but we also identified that there were no services for stalking victims. One of the things that I noticed as a common factor with these particular clients was that they were angry and they were very frustrated. And so I set out on a journey, I went on a personal journey to find out what that was about and be able to support them wherever they were. I went to two national trainings in the year 2006. In March of 2006, I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and went to a training called Investigating and Prosecuting Intimate Partner Stalking. And then in September of that year, I went to a training in Minneapolis called The Use of Technology in Intimate Partner Stalking. Each of those trainings were 3 days long, and the training that I do, I call it my down and dirty stalking 101 training, so I'm going to get a little bit of that to you today and am very open to coming back if you would like to have more training. Okay, I'm going to take a breath now. Okay, so in September of 2006, my executive director came to me and said, we have an opportunity to go after a pot of money where we might be able to provide services to stalking victims as well as write a protocol for law enforcement, prosecution, and victim services. And we went after the grant, we got the grant, and for the past 2 years, I've been working only with stalking victims. And we did write a protocol. We had Bloomington, the city of Bloomington, and the city of St. Louis Park, and law enforcement and prosecution, and myself. There were two law enforcement officers from each city, so we had seven people at the table for an entire year write this protocol. It was rolled out in February of 2008, and we had several, 125 law enforcement officers come to the training, and Mark Wynn came, and I understand he's coming here soon. Go. He's good. We rolled out the protocol in February of 2008 in draft form, and we finished it up and introduced it in final form in November of 2008. The second piece of that grant was to do trainings, and we did trainings with law enforcement, prosecution, victim services in the metro area. And one of the things that we found was every time I did a training, I was being asked to do at least two more. And so it was exponentially multiplying. I also provided direct service only to stalking victims, as I stated, and I created a support group for stalking victims. So I am going to play a video, and this video started my journey, really. In Atlanta, Georgia, I saw the sister who's speaking in this video, Peggy Klinke's sister, speak, and she spoke for an hour, and they showed this video. It was very moving to me, and I really wanted to catapult myself from this video and from that training into creating change in the state of Minnesota. So this video is 17 minutes long, and I do realize we're going to be short on time to get across some of the things that I would like to, but it is very important to see this video because it does give us some common language on the other side. So go for it.
Oh. You know, in the beginning, it seemed like a very fine relationship to me.
Hello. is Erin Brockovich, and I host the Lifetime television series, Final Justice. What you are about to see is a story about a crime that is misunderstood and far too often deadly, stalking. Peggy Klinke was stalked relentlessly by an ex-boyfriend. If you haven't experienced it, it's very hard to imagine the terror of what it feels like. It all began in the fall of 98. At the age of 28, my sister Peggy began preparing for medical school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She met and began dating a man named Patrick Kennedy.
You know, in the beginning, it seemed like a very fine relationship to me. They were dating, doing dating things, going to movies. But I noticed a switch in Peggy's personality. I just knew something wasn't right with my sister, and I wasn't sure why.
Peggy and Patrick's relationship lasted about 3 years altogether. In March of 2002, Peggy cut all ties with him. From the day she left him, he began stalking her. Calling her on her cell phone, begging her to come back, threatening her. He waited outside of her work. He waited outside of her gym, just watching her. Just watching her till it was a sort of a sign to let you know that I'm there and I'm watching your every move. He wanted her back in his life. And until he did, you know, he was just gonna persist with this. At one point, Peggy had called me in the afternoon and said, "You'll never believe this. Patrick jumped out of the bushes at work with a dozen roses and a wedding ring and asked me to marry him." And Peggy said, "I walked right by him, I got in my car and drove away." Peggy was very, very strong and very determined to shake this man from her life. And the more she ignored him, the angrier he got. Then he progressed to paperwork. He made a really nice 8.5 by 11 flyer with a photo of my sister on it, wrote all sorts of incredible obscenities about her and put her cell phone number on it and distributed where she had her nails done, where she had her haircut, where her gym was, where she worked. She took the flyer to the police and showed them that, but there was nothing they can do. It was only a flyer. But I think at that point, you know, we were still thinking that he was just playing a game. We didn't think it would escalate. And then he took greater steps because she wasn't reacting.
That June, our family gathered in Orlando, Florida for my brother's wedding. Peggy brought a new man she had begun dating, Mark Sparks.
Patrick knew that we would all be in Florida for this wedding. And he had flown to my mother's house in Poland, Ohio. And on her white garage doors with black spray paint, he sprayed PK is a whore on the doors.
Patrick then returned to Albuquerque to set fire to Mark's house.
I noticed I had about 8 messages on my cell phone and I knew something was wrong. So I listened to the messages. My neighbor, my mother, the police, the fire department were all calling and saying that my house was on fire. Right away, Peggy knew that Patrick had done this.
Peggy and Mark were going from hotel to hotel because they had nowhere to live because Mark's house was set on fire. We were at the point, we didn't want Peggy to call us because we didn't know if he was trying to trace a phone call. We didn't want him to find out Peggy's whereabouts. Peggy, it seemed for a while, was just in hiding.
Everything that Patrick did to Peggy, Peggy went and reported it to the police. She was getting very, very, very agitated with them because nothing was being done to stop this man from harassing her.
Patrick's behavior was escalating and Peggy got a restraining order. She went to the police and filed for stalking charges. The trial was delayed for several months. Nothing was being done.
It was extremely frustrating, and in a time where you're being hunted by somebody and you feel more victimized by going through the system to protect yourself, then what good is it?
And I remember Peggy coming home having a binder of probably 200-300 pages in it of just everything she had documented. Peggy did all the footwork. Peggy did everything. She did everything right, but nobody would help her. Why? I don't know the answer to that.
And at this point, Peggy asked the DA, "Will it take a bullet to my head for you to do something about this?"
With Patrick's behavior escalating, we just felt like, at least temporarily, let's get you out of here. Let's wait for this stalking trial to come up, and by that time we can determine whether it's safe for you to move back home.
Peggy soon left for Turlock, California to begin a new life. She did everything she could to leave no trace or trail to protect herself. 6 days before her stalking trial was to happen, Patrick found Peggy after months of searching.
So how did this happen? After paying a private investigator for information, Peggy's stalker drove to the Albuquerque airport, checked a handgun and a hunting rifle at the airline counter, and flew to San Jose, California. He retrieved his bag with his weapons, rented a car, and arrived at her neighborhood. He posed as a private investigator, approached a delivery driver who recognized her photo, and gave him her exact address.
He caught up with her on her way out of the house early Saturday morning. He duct taped her hands together, he choked her, and he beat her. He beat her so severely with his gun that her blonde hair turned bright red. Despite all of this, Peggy managed to break free and flee to a neighbor's apartment where she was able to call 911.
911 emergency. I have a stalker and he's here to kill me. He's here to pick me up and take me. He's in my house. 1410, number 118.
Who is
this?
Who is there?
Patrick Kennedy. He's beating me up with a gun. He's trying to break it down.
Does he have a gun right now?
No, he's already beat my head. If you don't get her, he's going to kill both of us.
Okay, we're on the way, ma'am. Now.
Are they on the way?
They're on their way.
Quickly. My head is stopping wet with blood. He gets in this house, he's going to kill us.
Stay on the line with me, ma'am. I'm staying on the line.
Oh, my God. How close are they?
They're on their way. Patrick?
I'm the only one here.
He ran.
Please.
Stop it.
Female.
Please, stop it.
I think I see him kill me.
Is he? Ma'am?
The SWAT team arrived. Peggy told them, if you open this door, he will kill me. And the police officer said, let's not talk about that, Peggy. Let's talk about your family. And Peggy had said, tell my mother that I love her. And tell my sister who's pregnant to name the baby after me. And tell my niece, Abby, she will have a guardian angel. And those were Peggy's three last requests before she was killed.
I just remember punching a hole in one of my walls, and I just, I started crying, and I just said, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry to Peggy, because, at that point, you just feel that I failed her, that the whole system failed her. You just feel powerless.
The doorbell rang. I saw two police officers. In that instant, I knew they didn't even have to come into the house because I knew what had happened. I said, just tell me, did Patrick Kennedy kill my sister? And what I was told that night was that he had found Peggy, he had shot her in the head with a gun, and then he had killed himself. I decided, you know what? Knowing Peggy's personality, Peggy would have been on a cell phone at my funeral trying to take action, trying to make something good come out of something so tragic.
We felt the same way, so we contacted retired Lieutenant Mark Wynn, a 20-year veteran of law enforcement and an expert in stalking and domestic violence.
This offender hit every high indicator on a lethality scale for a stalker. He stalked across county lines, across state lines. He did all the things that we teach police officers today to read in a case before homicide, because we believe that if you can read those signs, you can stop a stalker and you can stop a murderer.
Investigating a stalking case is like putting the pieces of a puzzle together. Each piece is necessary. You have to take the time to carefully and patiently listen to the victim to find out everything that's happened. Now, the victim may be focused initially on a single incident like vandalism to her car or a threat to her family, but you have to get all the information, including the minor things, in order to assess if you have a course of conduct. You also have to remember that unlike most other crimes, stalking behavior is ongoing. It's important to continue to monitor your stalking case even after the arrest to see if the behavior is still happening. Of critical importance in all stalking cases is putting the incidents in context. Often the behavior of the stalker will seem benign or harmless to someone who doesn't know the stalker. For example, many stalkers send love letters or flowers to the victim. You have to talk to the victim and ascertain why that particular behavior is so frightening to her or him.
The stalker may have told the victim that the day she was going to die would be the day that he would send her a dozen roses, or the love letter left on her doorstep, maybe his way of letting her know that he found her in her new home, which she thought was a secret from him. Context is everything in stalking cases. Your job as a police officer is to piece all these puzzles together, all these pieces of the puzzle together, so you can see a clear picture of the offender in front of you. Once you've interviewed the victim and the suspect's been identified, try to corroborate the victim's version of events in any way possible. Did any neighbors or someone in the workplace see the suspect? Are there photos or videos of the behavior? Any answering machine tapes, voicemail, or email? These things are helpful, but you don't have to have them. You can still proceed. Conducting an interview with a suspect can be very important in stalking cases. Many stalkers don't believe that what they're doing is wrong or illegal. Now, one technique that sometimes works is to open the interview with the suspect by asking, "Tell me how what you're doing is being misunderstood." Many detectives and investigators have found that stalkers enjoy talking about their behavior. Consider all the tools available to you: search warrants, surveillance operations, trash pulls, phone taps, and other techniques that law enforcement has successfully used in narcotics and other investigations. These can all be extremely useful in your stalking case. Now we know we've got an offender. This is easy. We know we have an offender who's after a particular victim. How easy could it get? All you have to do is to focus your investigation on the offender and the victim, and you catch the offender in the act of the stalking. It's not like it's someone who's going some unknown place to do some unknown crime. You know who they are. Stalkers have no boundaries. So we have all got to be on the same sheet of music. There's certainly more offenders than there are police officers, but I like to think that we're a heck of a lot smarter than they are. So we've got to communicate with one another. There's really no excuse why we can't talk across state and county lines, why we can't have mutual aid agreements between sheriffs and police from one county to one city to one state. Because these offenders move through these different places. They travel. We know victims run from state to state in domestic violence cases and stalking cases. We've got to be prepared for this. Stalkers seldom limit their criminal behavior to one specific jurisdiction. Therefore, law enforcement has to be ready with cooperative agreements and policies in place to enable them to effectively work together to investigate these cases. Since stalking behavior is often ongoing, it's important to establish how you're going to manage a stalking case over what may be weeks, months, or even years. Every police department in this country should have a policy or protocol for their officers on dealing with stalking. Policy is our direction, it's our mission, it gives you an assignment.
A stalking is a course of conduct directed at a specific person that would cause a reasonable person to feel fear. Now that fear is very real. Therefore, safety planning is crucial. It's a process that ideally involves many people: the victim, law enforcement, an advocate, the prosecutor, the victim's friends and neighbors, and anyone else could help the victim. The key here is to keep the victim safe and to hold the offender accountable.
Orders of protection or restraining orders often are looked at by the criminal justice system as a civil issue, something that's involved in a divorce or custody or visitation, when in fact, orders of protection or sort of that tripwire. It signals to you in government, especially law enforcement, that something worse is about to happen, because an order is clear. It's a sanction by a court to an offender of what you will and what you won't do. When an offender thumbs their nose at the court, this is an indicator that you've got high lethality on your hands, that you can't ignore it. There's no margin for error, and arresting for violation of order of protection is part of your counter-stalking. We've got to send a message to stalking victims that they can trust us, that they can depend on us, that we will investigate thoroughly, that we will offer safety before and after the arrest, and we'll deal with any other concerns that they have. You cannot minimize these cases. This is the most dangerous thing you can do in law enforcement. It's tombstone mentality. You cannot take a case like this and say, well, maybe it'll get better, because that's exactly what the offender wants. Once we give over to minimization, the offender takes over with maximization. That's exactly the way they look at it. They're depending on everybody to treat it less than a crime, and we can't do that. The longer we spend with a case, the more we're really going to see what the victim's been trying to tell us all along. And if you walk around in the shoes of a victim for a moment. And that's the way to do it, is to see the total picture. Once you do that, then you don't minimize, then you treat it right, then you thoroughly investigate, then you track down, then you prosecute, then the law keeps its promise.
Susan Herman is the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime.
In the United States, 1 in 12 women will be stalked in their lifetime, and 1 in 45 men. Every year, 1.4 million women in America are stalked, and the vast majority are female stalking victims stalked by someone they knew. Stalking and murder often go together. Almost one-third of women who are killed each year are killed by an intimate partner. Of those, 76% had also been stalked by that intimate partner in the year prior to their murder. 76%. Stalking is serious, pervasive, and lethal.
Police officers are often the first people that victims turn to, and you make an enormous difference in their lives. If you believe them, if you listen to them, if you treat them respectfully and sensitively, it is the most important single intervention, the most important moment for most victims of crime. You can and you do make an important difference every day.
For more information about stalking, you can contact the Stalking Resource Center at the National Center for Victims of Crime at 202-467-8700, or log on to the Stalking Resource Center's.
Thank you. Okay, there's a little handout that went around. It's a questionnaire. I'm just going to give you 2 minutes to look those over and answer them. Talk with your chairmates about the answers, and then we'll go over them together. I'm timing. Talk. Okay, I'm going to say the question out loud. I want you to say the answer back at me. Ready? The majority of stalking victims are celebrities.
False.
Yes. How many people are stalked in America every year? Very good. And that was on the video, and there have been new stats released that say it's 3.4 million now. Yeah. What percentage of women who are stalked by an intimate partner are sexually assaulted by that partner? 31, whoever said that. The majority of women stalked by their current or former intimate partner were also physically assaulted by that partner. Very good. What percentage of stalking victims are men? Someone said 22, I heard it up. Very good. Very good. What percentage of stalkers are women? Louder. 13, whoever said that up there. Very good. Most stalking victims who had obtained a protective order against their stalker had the protective order violated by the stalker. Very good. How many states have stalking laws? Wow, this is the first training I've done in a whole year where somebody actually knew that. Very good. Yes, all 50 states have stalking laws. What percentage of male stalking victims are stalked by other men? Most of them. It's 60. Yep. And that accounts for the GBLT community. GLBT, excuse me. I have dyslexia, so. And also significant others are thrown into that category. More than 80% of women who were stalked on campus knew their stalker. Very good. Awesome. You guys did a great job. Okay, in the 5 minutes or less that I have left, I'm going to just point out a couple of slides that I have. You don't have these as handouts, and which is good, because if you got the whole thing, you'd be wondering what it all meant when you left. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the legal definition of stalking. A pattern of behavior directed at a specific person that would cause a reasonable person to feel fear. So, given that description, who in the audience could maybe tell me what the difference is between harassment and stalking? Nope. Good guess, though. Very good guess. From the person who knew it was all 50 states. Anybody else? Okay. The difference between let me tell you a story. I had a client who called me, potential client, and said, I'm being stalked. Can you help me? And I said, okay, tell me about that. What's going on? And she said, well, I have this neighbor who lives right next door to me, and I have asthma. And in the summer, he's lighting his barbecue grill, and the smoke is billowing, and he's pushing the grill up to my window, and I'm having trouble breathing. And the short of that story is that is an annoying behavior. What we're looking for in the word when I was asking you is that this is annoying. Harassment is annoying behavior. That doesn't mean that pre-stalking, something that would fit the legal definition of stalking, shouldn't be looked at by advocacy groups. So as we move on here, the thing I want to point out is when we're talking about stalking, we are criminalizing non-criminal behavior. And usually I'll have a little pad up here that I write on so you guys can pretend that you're seeing what I'm talking about. If a victim calls the police and says, I just got a dozen roses on my doorstep and I'm really scared, can you do something? And law enforcement says, I'm sorry, we can't do anything about that because it's not against the law for someone to leave you flowers, which is true. They're telling the truth there. What we're looking at here is criminalizing non-criminal behavior. So the woman calls the next day and says, I got a letter on my car, and it's from him, and I'm really freaked out. Can you come and help me? Go arrest him. I'm really scared. And law enforcement says, it's only a letter. Third day, there's a bunch of phone calls that she's keeping track of. Okay? If we take the flower, the letter, and the phone calls, and what I generally do is put a big circle around it right now and say, if we combine those with the victim's feeling of fear, that's stalking. So if, for example, I have a boyfriend and I'm getting flowers and a letter and the phone calls and I'm not fearful, that would not fit the legal definition of stalking. Follow me? Okay. So generally what I do now is go through how the law applies to this and the definition of stalker, the categories of behavior of the stalker. But what I really want to do is get to the piece about how victims respond. There is a study that was done, and I'm hoping some of you may be familiar with the cycle of violence as defined for battered women. This is very similar in the cycle of crisis, where we have the anticipation phase. We're waiting for that jump out of the bushes. We're waiting for the flowers. We're anticipating that something's going to happen. There's the crisis phase, which is the event, the actual thing that happens. And then there is the recovery phase, where you have a little bit of downtime and you're kind of regrouping. But then you go into anticipation again. And the difference between the thing that's important for the stalking trauma syndrome is the repeated crisis, that a sexual assault is one event, or domestic violence battering is one event that may continue on. But with stalking, it's repeated, right, one right after the other. And the thing that happens in the stalking trauma syndrome is that the recovery phase goes away. So it goes from anticipation to crisis to anticipation to crisis. They are in crisis all the time. So when you're talking with a potential stalking victim, what you're seeing is somebody who's very frustrated and angry. They want this to stop. They want it to go away. So how does a victim present? Things that they say, they express. The fear that something's going to happen to them is absolutely overwhelming. They are so scared. They never, never should be underlined. Feel safe. They've moved or changed jobs. Somebody might call me and say, I'm having a problem with this guy, and I just moved to Minneapolis from South Dakota. That, to me, is an indication that she may be being stalked, even though she's not using that word. Okay? Express guilt that family or friends may be in danger. I have a victim who came to me because she was worried her mother was going to be hurt, justifiably so. First time they are reporting to the police. This could have gone on for 6 months before they actually report to the police. They're trying to manage it themselves. And then it's not just me, my family and friends can tell you how concerned they are for me. The stalker has done a rehearsal of the act that's being threatened. And I have a lot more to share about that, but I am aware of the time. Stalking and domestic violence do intersect. In the next slide, I'm going to give you a second to read that. Domestic violence victim who leave an abusive relationship. Let's just put it this way. Physical assault and stalking are more lethal than either one alone. And then there's one last thing that I want to add, which is in my other, I'm going to have to end. I'm going to give you a couple phone numbers. Can't walk away from the microphone. A couple phone numbers. One where you can reach me if you have any questions after today. I'm very happy to take a call from anywhere in the state of Minnesota. My direct phone number is 612-343-9845. And we do have a victim phone number. If you are a victim of stalking or know someone who is a victim of stalking, there is a line. It is not a hotline. In other words, it's not answered. But if they leave a phone number, I'm generally the person who's going to call them back. And that number is 612-343-0793. And I thank you. We'll give it to Lee. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm just going to quickly talk a little bit about what are we doing here in this community, and then I'll leave a few minutes for questions, too. And if you didn't get those numbers, we have those at the Women's Center and can hook you up with those. A little bit of history of how we got involved in this. A number of years ago, a graduate assistant, Danny Lindner, began doing some research in the area of stalking and what was happening, you know, just in the research area, but also what was or wasn't happening in our community. And what we found was even though those laws have been passed some years ago for stalking, they weren't really being utilized. And part of it was some confusion between harassment and stalking by everyone in the system, advocates, law enforcement, attorneys. And it was just a tool that they typically weren't using. So we wrote a grant and received it about a year ago, the Violence Against Women Act campus grant that deals with stalking, dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual assault. And a big portion of that grant is trying to increase and better our response to stalking. And a couple things around that is training. You mentioned Mark Wynn. He's been here in the past as an excellent speaker. He'll be coming in January 2010 to train all of the people in the systems from 911 dispatchers to law enforcement, attorneys, judges, and so on. And the other thing that we have found, and judges are catching up with this. I shouldn't say just judges. Some of them just tend to be a little older than others in the system. And they aren't always in tune with Facebook and MySpace and how maybe some of the college students, if they're doing some stalking, they utilize a lot of that stuff. So we really need to train people on cyber stalking. I remember meeting with the police chief and another advocate myself, and you're like, yeah, what's that stuff those college students use at the MySpace, what's it called? You know, they got all the names mixed up. My Face, My Book. but now they're really catching up with that, and as advocates, we're learning to how to bring that into the courtroom for harassment orders and so on so that they know how that's used. and certainly are looking at victim services and how we can improve safety planning and make that very specific for stalking victims and getting information out there. And I do want to say tonight at 7 o'clock in Ritchie Auditorium, we have speakers on Vicki and Eric Swenson. Vicki is a sister of someone who was murdered after being stalked by an ex-boyfriend, and along with her new husband, and you maybe have seen some of their story on TV. They did a home makeover show. They built a new house for them. Excellent speakers. I've heard Vicki before. I think they're going to be really good. So that's another piece. Please announce that in your classes and let people know. It's an excellent opportunity to learn more about this. The other things we're doing is just developing a tracking mechanism so we can see how do these cases start and how do they end. Because one of the things that we see happening is the stalker is doing stuff so quickly that the legal system's not keeping up. It may be different police officers that are getting all those reports. Some get turned over to the county attorney's office. Some don't because they can't prove the elements of the crime. And so by the time it gets to the county attorney's office, there may be all these other reports. They don't know about them yet because it hasn't they haven't been sent over to the office. And so seeing that context and how that's progressed is really important. And we're trying to create some protocols to deal with that. Our very end piece that we're going to do is develop some resource packets and make that available on our Chancellor's Office of MNSCU's website so other campuses can begin to use those resources and help their students on their campuses too. So I know we only have a couple minutes left, but do people have questions for either one of us?
I just wanted to comment that when you said Facebook, you commented your cyber-stalking. It just clicked that I had a former roommate, some guy contacted me because I was on the friend list and wanted me to give him a phone number. And I was like, whoa, that's exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just like, what a jerk, but then I can imagine that he saw her, who was her.
I'm amazed sometimes, so.